Well, thanks and welcome to our talk. So my name is Daan Keuper. I'm here with my colleague Thijs Alkemade. We work for CompuTest, a security firm in the Netherlands. We do pen testing, incident response, managed SOC, etc. But we also have a dedicated research team where we conduct research that we hope serves a public interest. And one of the research topics is was EV chargers for the Pwn2Own competition, and that's what we'd like to present today. So for at MCH, we did three talks, and then we thought that's a bit much because we did the presentation every day. So for this conference, we're also going to do three talks. This first talk was yesterday. This is the second talk, and tomorrow we have another talk about hacking a smart hub and how we get the firmware using some hardware hacking and some crypto vulnerabilities. So if you're into that, please go to our session tomorrow. Or if you want to know about other Pwn2Own entries, you could re-watch the, our talk from yesterday. So today, we want to talk about Pwn2Own Automotive. Pwn2Own is a competition where they invite researchers to demonstrate 0 days in various products. They have an automotive version, which is in Tokyo. And last year, we participated in the EV charger category. There are multiple categories, like infotainment units, chargers, etc. You have to demonstrate you can remotely get code execution on the latest version of the chargers. So these are the three chargers we looked at and we found vulnerabilities in, and we want to explain the vulnerabilities in our research process. They're all level 2 chargers. This means they're targeted at the home market. People can install this in their home for EV charging. Except for the Autel, that has a bit more functionality. That also has an NFC chip reader, so you could actually do payments with this charger. The rest is just plug in and go. So all of these come with internet connectivity. They typically come also with Bluetooth for initial configuration, and then with Wi-Fi or Ethernet connectivity, so you have a mobile app so you can do scheduling and users monitoring, etc. So our attack factor was make sure you're in Bluetooth or Wi-Fi range, then do whatever, and then get code execution on the charger. So, as I mentioned, these are the three chargers, a juice box, an Autel, and a charge point, and Thijs will discuss the vulnerabilities we found in our first charger, the juice box.
Yeah, so the Juicebox 40 is this charger. It has Bluetooth for the initial provisioning, so getting it set up on your Wi-Fi network. You need to get it, your Wi-Fi credentials to the device, and you don't have any keyboard to enter those. So you need Bluetooth to set up that initially. So as we described yesterday, before we actually start with a device, we first do some reconnaissance, like we try to understand what does the target look like, what can we already find online. And for this one, there was a rather interesting post on Reddit. I don't know if this is readable for everybody, but somebody mentioned that they could connect to Telnet on their charger on port 2000. But there's not even any mention of a password or whatever. So it looked like this charger had like public Telnet open on the Wi-Fi network. So that was one of the reasons we thought, yeah, this charger is one we're going to look at more closely, so then we ordered one. But because all of these models are like based in North America, I think, it took a while for them to ship and to get to us. We had to like go to some specific sites for this sort of stuff. So we did dig a little bit deeper in understanding the firmware before we even had the charger. And then we found out that this Juicebox charger is based on a platform. It's called the Zentry platform. So the way that it works is Silicon Labs develops a chip and then has a real-time operating system for that chip. So a very low-level firmware that doesn't run Linux or anything. And they combine this with a cloud service that you can use to manage these chips. So if you buy this, you get both the chip and the operating system and the cloud service to manage those devices. It sounds very cool, except keep in mind this operating system is end of life, so they don't provide any updates anymore. But we did figure out that we could still register on that platform and get some test devices, some test kits. And yeah, we could just download like the base operating system from the website. We could already start looking for vulnerabilities in that base operating system. So we didn't have like the Juicebox specific app, but we could look for like operating system vulnerabilities. And we actually found the vulnerability before the charge even got to us. So we had the exploit already ready. We just needed to verify it against the actual hardware. And the vulnerability that we found is in the functionality to log certain events. So with the command line access that you get over Telnet, you could reconfigure a lot of variables for the charger. And this includes like formatting for error messages or event messages, I guess. And in those event messages, you could use certain placeholders, like a, kind of like a format string, but certain things would get replaced. So for example, an at t would be replaced with the current timestamp or the SSID for at s. And there's a couple of different substitutions that can be there. And then, yeah, we looked at the code for this, and this is just a part of it for the timestamp one. If it's a t, then it copies some timestamp format into there. But notice there that the buffer that is going to copy into is 192 bytes, and there's no checking here that they are still in bounds of that buffer. So if we do multiple at t tags, we can our format string can be 32 bytes, so we can put 15 at t tags in there, which ends up being 345 bytes. But while the buffer is only in 192, so this is like a classic stack buffer overflow here. And because this is a very low-level real-time operating system, you don't need to think about any modern mitigations like ASLR or stack canaries or anything like that. You just straight up write over the safe program counter on the stack there. So, yeah, we had this very simple buffer overflow already discovered when we got the device. But then getting it to actually give us arbitrary code execution, that was a little bit more work because it needs to be a string that we send to the device. And for a string, there are certain characters that become complicated, like we can't use null bytes. We can also not use an at character because those get substituted and then discarded if we try to use them. And we found some way to get our code on the charger, but if we wanted to overwrite the program counter, we needed an extra null byte in there, and that wasn't possible with just string functions. So we had to find a trick for that. We noticed that in certain places they were using smprintf to copy data into that buffer. And like this is pretty common usage for smprintf. You keep track of where you are, you keep track of how much buffer there's remaining, and you advance your current pointer by how many bytes you copied. Now, this can be a vulnerability if... The way that they calculate that they are past the end of the buffer is by just subtracting the end from the current. But if you are already out of bounds, this value becomes negative, and you actually had like a safety check here. So if you are out of bounds, then the function would refuse to copy. So if you try to copy into very large string, and it would just return -1. So there's actually a safety check here, but they didn't actually account for that in the place where they called it. So they didn't check if they failed to copy. So what we can actually do is move our output back one step. So I'll try to demonstrate this with this picture to make it clearer. So we start in our output buffer, and then at some point the buffer ends, and we want to overwrite the part afterwards. We first overwrite to somewhere out of bounds, and then we use the timestamp, which makes the string null terminated at the end, to put the null byte that we needed right there. And then we actually move backwards two steps. Instead of generating more output, the smprintf call, returned minus one, so we could move backwards and write the 2 bytes that we needed into the buffer. So that way we could generate the address that we needed. We needed the 2 null bytes there, and we had overwritten the program counter with an address that we needed where we had our own shell code, and then we could just execute arbitrary code on the charger. So now back to Bluetooth. Well, is this related to the Bluetooth functionality on the charger? Well, this charger comes with a separate processor for handling Bluetooth, which communicates with the main Sentry operating system that I just mentioned. And it exposes these functionalities for sending those commands over Bluetooth. So you can just trigger this vulnerability entirely over Bluetooth, but only if it is in provisioning mode. So if it's just out of the box, it will be in provisioning mode, so you can use the Bluetooth functionality, but in normal usage, Bluetooth will not be on. However, Wi-Fi is quite easy to deauthenticate somebody off the network, so if you just deauthenticate them off the network long enough, it will eventually turn Bluetooth back on because it assumes that it's no longer configured. So for this device, the trick was just to get it deauthed from the network, trigger the provisioning mode again, and then exploit the vulnerability over Bluetooth. So how did they address this vulnerability? Their fix, well, as I mentioned, the vendor said, well, this operating system is end of life, so we're going to not offer a fix for this device. But I think this charger is still being sold today, so you can buy this charger with like multiple known vulnerabilities in it. Now for the next one, the Altel Maxi Charger. From all of the chargers that we bought, this one had the most luxurious feature set. It had like Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, 4G module in there. Came with a SIM card, even in the box. It has Ethernet, it has RFID for scanning the normal charging tags that you can use. There's an LCD touchscreen on there. It has an RS-485 port for integrating it into other systems. And it runs an operating system based on 3 RTOS. And one feature we found quite interesting in this charger is that in the app, you could configure this charger as a public charger, which means that other people can use your charger and then they pay for it to Altel, and then Altel will pay minus some percentage for the energy that they used. So you can make it public and generate some income from your charger. So for this charger, we also tried to get the firmware. We tried using the app, which is used for getting that firmware. We found that the way it gets its own firmware is that the app talks to the charger and the app talks to the cloud. So the app tells the cloud server, hey, I'm connected to this charger. It's currently on version 1.3. And then at a later point, it can ask the server, hey, do you have any updates? And then the server can reply back, I have no updates, or it replies back with a message that looks kind of like this. So this means that there's a newer firmware version, 1.35 in this case. And the first part is supposed to be a URL, but they have applied some kind of obfuscation on there. So it may look like Base64, but if you Base64 decode it, it is not really printable text. But if you stare at it a little bit longer, you can see that there is some parts of it that do look like a URL. So it could be HTTPS, S3, Amazon, AWS.com. If you look carefully, some of those characters are there. So it took quite a while, but eventually you figured out they just applied some substitutions on their Base64. So they swapped capital A and lowercase a around. This took embarrassingly long to figure out. We first tried to hook into the app, but it turned out to just be this. And then we downloaded the file, we looked at it, and wondered, is it encrypted? Well, we couldn't really get anything out of it. It looked like garbage. But if you plot the entropy, this is not a straight line. So if it's encrypted, then it's not properly encrypted. We again took quite a while applied some common methods, like they often do like a XOR with a fixed character or a fixed key or something like that. And we tried that, and we kept seeing weird patterns that just kept reoccurring and reoccurring, like this column is exactly the same as the column above. I think this is, and eventually, after solving, so we assumed that it might be using like a 256-byte key, but neither with XOR or an addition did it make any sense. So eventually we figured out they're using a combination of both. So they're using XOR with a key and then an addition with another key. And we had to really puzzle this out because, yeah, there's now two keys, so you cannot just, if you know the plain text, get the key back. So it was kind of like solving a large crossword puzzle where you can get some more constraints on every byte. And this took like 2 days to doing this by hand, guessing what the strings might be. So eventually, by looking at the patterns and guessing that strings often end in a new line and are followed by null bytes that might get padded up to 4 bytes, that sort of stuff eventually allowed us to get the full keys back, and then we figured out how to decrypt the firmware. And that was basically the hardest part of hacking this charger. So how does the charger, or how does the app communicate with the charger now that we have the firmware? So to use a charger, you need to register it on your account on the cloud, on the Autel cloud server. In order to do that, you need to have the serial number and the 8-digit code that's printed in the manual. You give that to the cloud, and then the cloud registers it to your account and gives you an authentication token. And then you can, your app can connect to the charger, and then they have this handshake protocol. They both pick a random number, and then they calculate the hash with the two random numbers and the authentication token that you got from the server. So the authentication token is unique per charger, and the server keeps track of them. And this way, the charger can verify that you are authenticated to use it without having to talk to the cloud itself. So we looked at the checking of this functionality. And this is like the loop where they loop over the hash to check if the computed hash is equal to the one that they received from the app. But then we scrolled a little bit further in this function, and we noticed some additional checking. If the initial authentication token didn't work, then it tries a second token that is hard-coded in the firmware. But the rest of the protocol is just the same. It's just a hard-coded token that was basically the same for every charger. And if that works, then it logs this message down there. It sets you as authenticated and logs off BD suck. Now, I don't want to claim this is a backdoor, but they do log off BD suck. And I don't really know what else they could mean by that. So we had this authentication bypass, we could now talk to the charger. And this charger you can completely configure over Bluetooth. It can use Wi-Fi, but the configuring of the charger is really meant to work over Bluetooth. And there's multiple different messages the app can send to the charger to reconfigure various parts. And it took only a few hours of looking at the code to notice that there was a straight up memcopy of a stack buffer with an arbitrary length. So this is 60-byte stack buffer. They memcopy the entire Bluetooth buffer into there and stack buffer overflow. Now, in this case, again, binary exploitation was really easy because it's a real-time operating system with no mitigations, no stack canaries, no ASLR. In this case, we are not limited on the character sets because it's just a Bluetooth message. It doesn't need to be a string. We had a lot of saved registers. So getting this shellcode working was quite easy. It was a bit harder to make sure that it didn't crash afterwards because it's a real-time operating system. You need to do cleanup quite well. But overall, getting this exploit to work was only a matter of hours. But then, so the way this competition works is that they set out the targets, and then everybody can look at those chargers and look for vulnerabilities. But if they have multiple entries in the point zone competition against the same target, then they do a random drawing. And if you're later in the drawing, you get a lower reward. But if you have the same vulnerability as somebody else, your reward gets even lower again. And this was like two really obvious vulnerabilities, we thought. So this last one, we thought, so the first one, the authentication bypass, we thought we're probably not going to be able to avoid that because it opens up so much more attack surface. So we thought, let's see if we can find a more subtle memory buffer overflow instead of the really obvious one in this first packet. So just like a week before we actually went to the competition, I was still going through the code looking for something more subtle because we're not going to find a new vulnerability on a new target, so let's just make sure our vulnerabilities that we have are as good as they can be. And we eventually found something better. So this is a function that Base64 decodes some data. It's a little bit more complex because we need to reconfigure the charger to connect to a server and then download some Base64. But in the end, this is again a stack buffer overflow where it's a fixed size buffer and they just decode an arbitrary link string into there. So overall, this is basically the exploit could be the same, but it was a little bit more subtle. So we had more confidence that this would not be a dupe, while the other one was indeed found to be a duplicate with other teams. Now, the next one is going to be the ChargePoint Home Flex, and I'm going to hand over to Dan for this.
So, the ChargePoint, another charger with Bluetooth, with BLE provisioning, it has Wi-Fi. It runs Linux, unless like the others run the real-time operating system, this one runs Linux. And it had some prior research by Kaspersky Labs. They found some trivial buffer overflow in the setting the password for the Wi-Fi functionality. So if you connect to Bluetooth, you could configure Wi-Fi, and if the password was too long, you would just overflow in a fixed-size stack buffer. So very trivial. So we thought, okay, this is up to a great start. Let's see if we can find any other vulnerabilities. This charger, we had the least amount of time for because Amazon lost our charger. So we had to reorder it from the US. So it arrived just in time for the competition. So the hardest part for this charger was actually getting the firmware. They have U-boot locked down. We didn't know the password for Linux. So there are a couple of options, like dumping the flash chip directly, desoldering, whatever. But then we noticed that they have JTAG enabled on the board. So we could actually halt the CPU, attach a debugger, etc. So what we end up doing was we just used JTAG to reset, halt the CPU, then attach a breakpoint to the moment that U-boot would do out-of-boot, disable out-of-boot, and then we could just change the init system to a shell and drop a suet shell for us to use later on. So this is actually the hardest part for this charger. The rest took only 20 minutes. So what we thought, okay, let's look at the Wi-Fi configuration stuff as well. Because Kaspersky already found a vulnerability here. So how it works is you have the onboard daemon that is actually handling the Wi-Fi of the Bluetooth connectivity, and for every packet it will send it to using IPC to some app that is responsible for handling that message. In the case for Wi-Fi configuration, that is WLAN app. So once we figure that out, we just looked at WLAN app. Okay, how does it use that username and password fields, or the SSID and password fields? It turns out that they just build a command, shell command, and they directly run that on a shell. No escaping, nothing. So you could actually just get code execution using their mobile app by just inserting shell commands with a backtick, and that would just run on the device. So super easy vulnerability. And we thought, okay, other people are definitely also have found this. And that was correct. We were very unlucky in the drawing. Like, we were number 7 or so on the list, and they all had the first guy got lucky because he could use this vulnerability, and the rest, all bug collisions, they all had the same vulnerability. So we were in Tokyo at the time. We were a bit sleep deprived because due to a jet lag and us clubbing every night. So we thought, okay, if we go on stage tomorrow, this was the last day, we were very lost, We're definitely going to get a bug collision because this bug has been burned by now. So maybe we can just find another vulnerability this evening, and maybe we get lucky. So the problem here was that our charger was in our office in the Netherlands. We are in Tokyo. Due to time zone differences, we were working at a time that the office was closed, so nobody was there. So we were a bit constrained on all the functionalities that we could abuse, or the attack vectors that we had, because we were not in Bluetooth range. So the whole Bluetooth vector was out of scope. So we were limited to the Wi-Fi attack surface. And obviously, we needed something that was very stable, because since the office was closed, if we would crash the charger and we couldn't reset it remotely, then we had nothing. So it had to be reliable as well. And the other problem was that we found out that we had the wrong firmware on our charger, because you cannot update chargers yourself. That's pushed remotely by ChargePoint at a random moment in time. And we learned that we were run on a slightly older version of the firmware. So anything with memory corruption or so, we couldn't really use, because it could very well be that our offsets were wrong due to the latest version having slightly different offsets. So let's look at the Wi-Fi attack surface. So it only has Telnet listening. But we didn't know the password. We tried brute forcing the password for a while on a cluster, but we couldn't get it. So that wasn't really, that doesn't give us anything. There is an outgoing WebSocket connection to the ChargePoint cloud environment, which uses SSL. And we already tried to intercept this, but it failed due to a certificate error, which was to be expected. So we ignored that attack vector during our initial research. And that has an outgoing SSH connection, which is kind of interesting. But basically what it does, it does an outgoing SSH connection to some server, and it builds a reverse proxy or reverse tunnel to make sure that a charge point can always telnet into their charger. I think it's for emergency support or something. We don't really know. It's interesting functionality. And we, of course, can intercept this SSH connection that didn't verify the key. So we could do that, but then we only get access to the telnet port that we already have access to, so that didn't give us much. So we tried to see, okay, let's focus on that WebSocket connection. Let's see if we can bypass that certificate validation in some shape or form. So the WebSocket connection comes from a configuration file. This is the endpoint that it tries to connect to. And as you can see, they set verify host name to 1, which we assumed would be set to enable. Turned out that we were wrong. We remembered an old article about this vulnerability, because they used curl, and that value ended up to be set to curl opt SSL verify hosts, which is kind of a footgun in all the versions which ChargePoint used. 0 means disabled, 1 means disabled, and 2 means enabled. They set it to 1. The whole reason why it didn't work initially is that they didn't have, it needs to be from a signed by a root certificate that was installed on the device. So we needed a certificate signed with our own root. But luckily, the charger has one for us. So we just extracted a certificate with a key from the charger, and then we could successfully intercept the WebSocket connection, which, of course, gives us much more attack surface to work with. So over the WebSocket connection, they use the OCPP protocol, which is a standard protocol in EV charging, which it's just basic JSON with over WebSockets. So this all was made possible by the fact that our hotel had a beer vending machine. Basically you can buy beer 24 hours, 24/7. They just trust you that you're on the legal age of drinking. So we did an all-nighter hacking marathon to see if we can get an exploit to work. It was 11 p.m. at this moment. We were drunk, sleep-deprived, and on a mission, so we got to work. Intercepting the WebSocket connection was actually harder than it sounds, or especially in our condition, because they used a very old certificate, so none of our current tools would accept the certificate, so we had to hack the tools a bit to make it accept our certificate. Then we had a problem that they used a non-compliant WebSocket library, so our WebSocket library also complained, so we had to patch the WebSocket library before this actually got to work. But then we have the messages. These are the messages that are sent, or at least the structure. And within the OCCP protocol, you also have specific vendor messages, which are custom fields. You can basically send whatever. And this is the format that they are using. It has some serial number, a function, some arguments, etc. So we spent hours looking for easy ways to turn this into command execution. There's one daemon that handles all these messages, but based on the command, it will send various IPC messages to other random daemons on the system, and they will use that data for whatever. So we needed an easy target. So we spent the entire night looking for daemons. Okay, does it receive IPC messages from this daemon? How does it handle those messages? And does it end up in a place that we actually can exploit? So we found a lot of strict copies or memory corruption bugs, but that was a bit tricky to do at 3 p.m. or 3 a.m. So at the end, we did found a easy command injection. There is somewhere they have a payload. It's for rebooting the charger. It's a reboot message. And the data that comes from the WebSocket connection is directly passed into a system command. I have no idea why this is part of the functionality. But around 4 a.m. we found this. We then needed to exploit this, of course. Because after it would execute our system commands, the charger would reboot. So we needed something that was persistent, and we needed something that we would 100% sure that would work and wouldn't break the charger in any way, because we were not near the charger. So if it would break, we had no way to recover. We couldn't try anything else. So we thought about, okay, it just overwrites the init script or an init file or whatever, but it could very well be that that would trip some watchdog timer or so, and then would make the charger go into an endless loop or whatever, and then we would lose all connectivity. In the end, what we just did was we wrote something to init tab to run that reboot that would just spawn a bind shell on a certain port. So then I got to work to actually write the report at 7 a.m. because you also have to hand in the report. And our entry was due at 11 a.m. So completely sleep deprived, we came to the competition and we got lucky. It worked on the first try, and it was not a duplicate. So I have a video of this in how it works. We just run the exploit. So we reconfigure the charger over Bluetooth to connect to our Wi-Fi network, because Bluetooth is always enabled and it is unauthenticated, so we can just arbitrarily do this. We intercept the WebSocket connection. We need to wait for the charger to reboot. I'll skip over in the video because that takes some time, of course. So it's back online, we can connect to our bind shell and run arbitrary commands. So, but we still had a little bit energy left in us, and we thought, okay, let's look at that SSH connection one last time, because it's such a weird construct, like connecting to a server of them and then setting a reverse proxy to your telnet port. Why is this actually there and how does it work? Well, there is a script, and based on your serial number, it will connect to A server. B picking a random port, or based on the serial number, we'll also pick a reverse proxy port to Telnet back to us, open Telnet back to us. So we thought, okay, maybe we can connect to this server as well and execute commands on their cloud environment. That didn't work. It was only allowed for us to do port forwarding. So we're like, this is the command that's actually executing. We're like, okay, can we? What else can we do with this? So maybe we can access Telnet daemons of other chargers. Well, that seems to work. We could reach other chargers over Telnet, but obviously we didn't have the password for our own charger, so we also don't have the password for other chargers, so we don't really, it doesn't gain us much. So then we thought, okay, we can proxy to other chargers. Can we also proxy to arbitrary hosts? Well, that works. We can proxy through their server to google.com. Which is also nice, of course, it's an open proxy, but doesn't really gain us anything. So then we thought, okay, we noticed that this whole cloud infrastructure was hosted on Amazon. We were like, okay, can we access the metadata server? Well, turns out you can. You can get an access key. This is just an IAM user. It has an actual role with credentials. So we could get a token, and we were like, okay, let's hope that this access key doesn't have access to anything sensitive, so we tried to poke around a little bit. We tried to list all the S3 buckets, and this is the entire, this is a part of the list. It is 142 buckets. It had interesting names with prods and PII and a data lake, etc. We poked around, so we can actually read in these buckets, but we didn't download any files because this was clearly out of scope for the competition. But of course, this was an interesting find. Of course, you can say, what is the impact of hacking chargers? Like, no hacker is going to sit near an random EV charger attached to a home. So, and I think that's typically that would be true. Most hackers won't be bothered maybe to hack your own charger for fun. But of course, all those chargers connect to cloud infrastructure. And if you can hack the cloud infrastructure, then this, of course, becomes a problem. If you have all the chargers at once and you can turn them on and on at the same time, simultaneously, then you could, of course, damage the grid rather quickly. Another impact thing that is the Autel had that payment system where you could charge other people to use your charger. Basically, then the charger becomes like a payment terminal. The card has no way to know where it's charged, so that's not going to tell the Autel about how much current they used. The NFC tag that you use for reading also has no way to communicate with the server. So the only thing that knows how much power somebody used is the charger itself. So that should be reliable, of course. So basically, the security level of such devices need to be up to the same level as a random payment terminal. Well, I think we demonstrated that that is clearly not the case for the EV chargers that we looked at. On other impact, like maybe an EV charger, an hacked EV charger could damage a car or something, but I think that's very, very unlikely. We didn't test this, but I would assume that any car would be protected against a malicious EV charger. Because if that's not intentional, it might be malfunctioning, of course, and the car needs to account for this. So if you want to read our write-ups of all these vulnerabilities, they're on our blog. You can scan the QR codes. They're up there. And if you want to know more about firmware hacking and hardware hacking, come to our session tomorrow. And if there are any questions, I will be glad to answer them.
Applause well earned. If you have any questions, please line up at the microphone here, or I think there's also one back there. And please, first question on the microphone in the front.
Thank you for the nice talk. Have you guys also looked into the open, or what's it called, smart EVSE?
No, we haven't. But we can, of course, take a look if that's if that's interesting. But no.
I think it is. Code is on GitHub.
Okay, cool. Challenge accepted.
Do we have a question from the internet? Any more Q&A? Any more questions? Oh, yes, there's one.
Thank you. Wonderful talk. I would like to ask if you have ever evaluated Victron Energy products, which I believe are a Dutch company.
Sorry, which one?
Victron Energy. They are very much used on boats.
Ah, okay. No, for the competition, we only looked at these chargers, so we haven't looked at any other charger. No. If they can supply us one, we might take a look. Yeah, cool.
Any more questions? Oh, yes, and questions from the internet, please.
Not really from the internet, but rather a Signal Little Angel question, personally. Did you estimate how many charge points were online, or did you check how many stations would be affected?
Yeah, we didn't check, but I think charge points is one of the largest.
Yeah. I think in the US they are one of the largest for public chargers, and we're not really clear on how many, if that infrastructure is shared with what we gained access to. So, yeah, potentially like many thousands, 100,000 maybe.
I spoke with somebody from ChargePoint, or I heard a talk from somebody from ChargePoint, and he mentioned that they have a security certificate in the certification in the US that nobody else has. So they win a lot of government contracts because they have secure charging and the competitors don't. So.
Okay, thank you. If there are no more questions, yeah, there is one more question.
Second question from the Signal Angel. why do companies submit such devices if they should know that it's end of life and things like that?
For the competition, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah,
exactly.
So they actually don't sign up themselves. ZDI, the competition owners, just picks the targets. And they, like for the big vendors, for Tesla, or for those have a competition where you target Chrome or Microsoft stuff, etc. They have very good relationship with those vendors. So they are typically there in the disclosure room and everything is nice. For chargers, they had zero communication with most of the charging charger companies. They did try to invite them to the competition, make them be part of the disclosure process, etc. But most of the charging companies or the manufacturers were like, okay, this is nothing, has something we want to be part of, and they ignored all emails, all calls, etc. ZDI does submit all vulnerabilities to the actual vendor for so that they can get fixed. But there is no real relationship between the manufacturers and the competition.
Last chance for any question? No takers? Okay. Then if you're leaving, then that concludes the talk. At first, big applause again.